Okay, our first speaker for this part of the session is Fred Espenak, and I think we all know that Fred has been a big contributor to the Eclipse community through all of the Eclipse publications. This afternoon he's going to be talking about one of them, the 5 millennium canon of solar eclipses, from minus 1999 to plus 3000. Fred?
Thanks a lot, Ralph. Delighted to be here. It's been 3 years since this group has gotten together, and we've had a number of eclipses, so I just couldn't resist the temptation just to share a couple of photographs of recent eclipses before I get into my main topic. In 2005, I'm also suffering from about 12 time zones of jet lag, so forgive me if I stumble over some of my words. In 2005, there was the hybrid eclipse that was pretty much over the Pacific Ocean. By the time it reached Panama, it regressed to annular again. But there were several ships that traveled out into the path of totality, the Paul Gauguin, I think one was the Discovery, was it?
Yeah.
And then the Galapagos out of the MV Galapagos out of the Galapagos Islands. And this blue section of the path here is the totality section. The red ends are the annular zones. And you can see the approximate locations of the Galapagos Legend and the Paul Gauguin. And we were on a group on the Galapagos Legend with astronomical tours with Vic and Jen Winter. And that's the ship. I think it was the smallest of the three ships. I think we had about 80 or so people on board. The Galapagos was a real treat before going to the eclipse trip itself. Visiting, of course, the Galapagos tortoise, the sea of marine iguanas, very prehistoric, the blue-footed boobies. It's some of the most abundant wildlife I've ever seen. Any place on Earth, we definitely want to go back even without an eclipse. On eclipse day, we were about 1,000 kilometers west of the Galapagos after several days' journey, set up for about 29 seconds of totality. The ship was quite rocky during the eclipse. The sun's image was shifting plus or minus 8 degrees in the viewfinder of this 500 millimeter lens I had. This is maybe four times or five times speeded up video shot beginning about 30 seconds before totality, just to give you an idea of the image motion on the ship. Here comes a shadow. Now let's see. Do we have yes, we don't have an audio feed. I'm just going to put the microphone down to the mic on this computer, because we also Greg Buchwald handheld a video camera and was fairly successful under the circumstances, but I think you'll enjoy this.
There we go.
Yes!
leave the sound on.
Nice going, Greg. Well, just to give you an idea again of the image motion, these are two photographs with a programmed camera set up behind me during totality, so you can see where the Sun and Venus are in that frame, and in the next frame. So they've switched quite a bit. These are a contact sheet of the images that I was shooting. This was my 19th total eclipse, and it's the very first one that I did not get to look at with the naked eye. Because I was busy hanging onto the back of that camera trying to keep it on the sun, and you can see it moving all over the frame here as I managed to get off about 7 or 8 frames, changing shutter speed so I could get enough to do a composite.
Pull your mic towards yourself.
Towards me?
Yeah.
Okay, is that better? Just a couple of shots taken from that sequence.
Move it away from the ceiling and towards your chair to go.
How about that? Okay. Of course, now I can't move. Okay, and this was, I think, a 15th of a second, considering we were on a rocking ship. That wasn't too bad. And there's a composite from about 8 separate shots. I could finally relax after totality. Well, the following year was the 2006 through Africa and Central Asia. And we were in North Libya, south of Jalu, with a couple thousand of our best friends in the tent camp that had been erected there by the government. And on eclipse day, you saw exactly what you want to see, a bright, crystal clear photometric sky. So we were ready. This sequence is going into totality. This is totality minus 30 seconds, 10 seconds, totality. Sequence. This was a real luxury using a digital camera for this eclipse because I didn't have to worry about running out of 36 shots. So during the diamond ring, I just hit the button and held it down. That's a 1 second exposure unprocessed. I'm sorry, that's the 1 second exposure process. And a sequence to produce a composite. Video.
Oh, look at it out that way. Oh, there's Venus. Bright as day. 50 seconds.
Of screaming. And a lot of image processing afterwards, although I was just using some commercial software, Photoshop. But this was from, I think, about 20 separate exposures. A little higher spatial frequency to get more detail. And I was interested to hear Voito point out that coronal curtain that I had seen. I had thought that was some type of works better when I point it at the screen. That curtain up here that I had seen, I thought it was some type of an artifact, but it seems like everybody's getting that. And a wide field view that's closer to the naked eye impression, at least what I remember. And that's sort of a mugshot of the group of us, a subset of our group that did some camping in the desert for a week before the eclipse. Well, I could spend 2 hours talking about some of these eclipse trips and some of the exotic places we've been to, but I need to move on to the topic at hand, and that's the canon of solar eclipses. Well, any discussion of eclipse calculations, if you want to start at the beginning, you have to mention and bring up Isaac Newton, whose work, the Principia, is probably, if not the most important piece of science done. It's certainly in the top five or top two. And it was really Newton's work that allowed Halley the chance to investigate a topic he was very interested in, because Newton's Principia allowed Halley to make detailed calculations of the moon's position for the first time. And with that, Halley could start investigating one of the many topics he was interested in, and namely, looking at historical eclipses and biblical references to eclipses and trying to identify them in history and determine when particular eclipses took place. And Halley was revolutionary in that sense, that he produced, if not the first map, one of the very first maps showing the path of a total eclipse. This one, 1715. Another one in 1724. England was very fortunate in having two of them break during that period. And these are both the Halley's maps, and they're a great source of reference for doing any type of eclipse mapping even today. Well, throughout the 18th century, the mapping of eclipses was a fairly haphazard process. People would be interested in any one particular eclipse, and they may go to the trouble of generating a map. As you can imagine, this was all done by pencil and paper, and it was a very laborious job to try to calculate the circumstances and the northern and southern limits for any one particular eclipse. So when you did one of these calculations, you were focused just specifically on one particular eclipse. Here's a map done in the later 18th century by Stickley, who is better known for doing a lot of archaeological work with Stonehenge in England. But he was also interested in historical eclipses, and he made this map trying to identify the map of Thales' eclipse with the battle between the Medes and the Lydians. And this particular eclipse that he identified was the wrong one, but still it's a nice illustration of the type of map that was being done at that point in time. Well, we move on to the 1800s. And in 1841, really the star of eclipse predictions showed up on the scene, Theodor Opelzer. Again, he was born in 1841 in Prague. But by the time he was 19, he published his first paper on the orbital elements of a comet. And 4 years, 4 or 5 years later, by the time he was 24, he had published over 50 papers on orbital determination. So he had a real penchant for doing celestial mechanics. He was, the next year in 1866, he became a lecturer at the University of Vienna. And in the 1870s, his interest started turning towards, again, eclipses, and in particular historical eclipses, trying to identify eclipses with historical records. He was frustrated, though, because of the paucity of eclipse maps. There were very few around, and they focused on just specific eclipses. And the first problem he had to overcome was determining when new moon and full moon took place. So he devised his own tables of syzygy as a stepping stone for calculating future and past eclipses. He published that syzygy tables in 1881, and at that point he had the basic tool he needed for now developing what he dreamed of as this canon of eclipses, where he could have maps of eclipses going back several millennia. Now, this is an awesome amount of work, so it required help. He couldn't do it all by himself. In fact, he actually didn't do any of the eclipse calculations himself. He thought he had laid the groundwork, set everything up, and he got, he must have been a real operator, because he got five of his friends to do the calculations for him in two teams. So they would cross-check each other by doing the calculations. But that grew old pretty quickly. He ended up having to hire five more people to do the calculations. I think he was paying them one guilder per eclipse, which was the equivalent of a cheap lunch back in those days. But in any case, after several years of these calculations, he had a manuscript ready for publication. And this manuscript, I think it had somewhere in the order of, let me look at my numbers here. It was 10 million figures, approximately 10 million figures, filling 242 thick folders or phylo books of calculations to do this thing. And his canon covered 33 centuries of work, his great canon of eclipses, from minus 1205 to plus 2161. Had the eclipse elements for 8,000 solar eclipses and 5,200 lunar eclipses. So with these particular elements published in the canon, you could go through and calculate more specific details, local circumstances for an eclipse. Or for solar eclipses, you could calculate more points along the eclipse path if you wanted. And he included 160 maps that showed the Earth from above the North Pole and went as far south as about 30 degrees south. So here's an example of one of Ruppelsohr's maps, showing a view of eclipses from 1963 through 1984, and you can see the detail at which he did it. The important thing to remember, since these maps were all hand drawn and it was very time consuming to calculate the coordinates of an eclipse path at any one point. He only calculated positions for 3 points for each eclipse: sunrise, sunset, and noontime. And what he did to fill out the rest of the eclipse path was he simply fit a circular curve through it. That has certain limitations, but given the technology of the time, it was a good compromise. Well, I'll talk a little bit more about the errors involved in that, those assumptions in a few minutes. Jump a century ahead to the 1960s, and Jean Mayus arrives on the scene, who I'm sure everybody has at least two or three of his books on their bookshelves. He and several colleagues, Grosjean and van der Leen, published this fantastic Bible of solar eclipses, the Canon of Solar Eclipses, in 1966. And this was a bit different from Ruppelsohr's canon, because while Ruppelsohr was focused on the past, Mayus' canon was focused primarily on the future eclipses. It covered about six centuries, and it began with 1898 through 2510. So it didn't go that far back into history. In this case, it included Bessillian elements for all 1,449 eclipses in the canon. So you could calculate anything you liked in great detail about the eclipse. It included two pairs of maps for each set, each time period, a northern hemisphere map and a southern hemisphere map. So you could see the eclipse paths in a little more detail. And he also calculated the position of the eclipse path at numerous points, not just at sunrise, sunset, and noon. So the paths were considerably more accurate. Finally, he also included tables of the central eclipse path coordinates at, I think, something like 5-minute intervals or 6-minute intervals along the eclipse path. Here's a typical map from Mayus et al. The same time period, 1963 through 1984, but now it's instructive to compare Mayus's 1966 canon with Oopelzer. One more thing. Here's a, just for an example, there's a Southern Hemisphere map. And you can see he's also differentiated between annulars and totals, giving them the totals are solid lines, the annulars are the dashed. But here we see Oopelzer and Mayus compared side by side, and you can start to see the differences. In particular, the 1970 eclipse that went through northern Florida, if you look at Oopelzer here, you see it goes through central Florida. And that was just a problem with using just a circular curve through three points. If you look at his sunrise and sunset points and his noon points, they are pretty good, even by modern standards. It's just fitting a circular curve through it is not the best approximation, but the best they had at the time, given that he didn't want to spend three lifetimes public working on this publication. Well, I got interested in eclipses in 1970 when we had a total eclipse through the eastern U.S. And I traveled down to North Carolina, even managed to get some photographs of it. One thing I didn't expect, there were a lot of things I didn't expect on that eclipse trip. I didn't expect to be so overwhelmed by the corona. But I also was amazed that I had just driven down there and pulled into a hotel of convenience, and thought that the hotel staff would be looking at us very strangely, because me and my high school chum were setting up this telescope, and they thought we'd be really odd. But we went into the backyard of the hotel, and it was literally filled with people staying at the hotel doing the very same thing. So there were hundreds of us down there for this eclipse, so I realized there were lots of other people out there that were interested in this stuff. Well, I was hooked after seeing that eclipse, and I started traveling around to any eclipse I could while going to college and university and graduate school. My second eclipse in 72 was a cloud out, so I got my first disappointment early in the game and found out what that tasted like. 73 to Africa, and the first member that I was able to see of Saros 136, this great Saros series that produces these very long eclipses during the 20th and 21st century. During this period, I realized that there was a lot of time in between total eclipses to do other things besides my university studies and graduate school, but I got interested in eclipse predicting. Because the publications that were out there, as wonderful as the 1966 canon was, it didn't have as much detail as I wanted. I wanted to see where the northern and southern limits of these eclipse paths were. The Naval Observatory published wonderful circulars, but they were only published a year or so before each eclipse, and I wanted to think 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the line to look at some of these eclipses. So I used I started out using Mayus's canon, which had some nice algorithms in them, to start writing my own eclipse software. And for some of the younger folks in the crowd, this might be instructive, because this was back in the Stone Age. We were using Fortran 4, and all my computer programs were on punch cards. There were no CRT or LCD screens to have direct interaction with the computer. You had to punch code your program on punch cards, put a couple of rubber bands on your card deck, be careful not to drop it, leave it off at the service desk, and come back 24 hours later to find out where your next syntax error was. It was a rather long learning curve on getting your program to work properly. In 1976, I started work at Goddard Space Flight Center, and with regard to my eclipse interests, I discovered two great things there. They had something called the Wolfblot World Database, which was a low-resolution database, but it gave me the outlines of all the continents. And now I started thinking about maps, which had been my ulterior motive all along. And they also had something called the VersaPlot pen plotter, which was about this yard-wide table that had a liquid pen that slowly traced along and converted your coordinates into curves. So you could plot the Wolfblot database and the eclipse coordinates onto it. So that got me up and running with making some maps. By 1978, I published my first eclipse predictions paper on the February 1979 eclipse through Canada in the Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. And the summer before that eclipse in Stellafane in Springfield, Vermont, I went up and I gave a talk on the 1979 eclipse. And for me, that was fairly significant because that's where I met this wild-eyed meteorologist named Jay Anderson. We had this lively discussion about weather prospects for the 1979. He had a vested interest in it since it ran through his home turf. So we had a lot of conversations about that. No email, so we were mailing letters back and forth back in those days. But I was very interested to hear what his weather prospects were. I ended up in Manitoba for the eclipse and managed to see it, even though we had been assured 12 hours before that I think, quote, there was not a snowball's chance in hell that it would be clear for the eclipse. But you never know. You definitely don't see the eclipse when you stay home. When it's elsewhere. Well, the next major canon of eclipses that showed up on the scene was once again Jean Mius, this time teamed up with Herman Mookie, and they produced a new canon of eclipses that was really directed more at the old Oopelzer-style canon, in which it was focused on looking at eclipses mostly in the past as a historical tool for archaeologists and historians. This particular canon covered 35 centuries, from minus 2003 to plus 2526. It had Besselian elements for all 10,774 eclipses. It had maps for each, an individual map for each one of those eclipses, with using a global projection and a simplified geometry. And it was the successor for Oopelzer canon of eclipses. Here's an example of one of the pages from his canon. You can see that each eclipse, there are 35 maps, 35 eclipses per page. This is basically a view. The projection here is, imagine that you are on the sun looking back at the Earth, and you're watching the path of the moon's trajectory across the Earth. There's a simplicity in this geometry in that or an approximation here, because they do not take into account the rotation of the Earth during the eclipse. They simply look at the face of the Earth at mid-eclipse and then look at the path of the moon across the Earth's disk. And it gives you at least an approximation for where the central line of the eclipse is and where the northern and southern limits are, which is all you really need for historians just to get an idea whether a particular eclipse was visible from Mesopotamia or England or whatever, wherever. So it was well suited to that particular goal. Well, I continue chasing eclipses. It's dirty work, but somebody's got to do it. My wife claims I still have them. Buried someplace. The next book on eclipse maps was published by Stevenson and Holden in 1986. But this one wasn't as useful to most of us here in the room. This was focused specifically at historians, and specifically at historians of East Asia, because it had very nicely detailed maps that covered East Asia and China with path coordinates. But again, it was aimed primarily at historians, and it only went as far as the year 1900. Well, it was about this time that I finally got around to publishing my first canon of eclipses. I really never told NASA about it, but really the subtitle of this book was my motivation. It's my motivation. I said, I really want a canon that's going to be useful for me in planning future eclipse trips with maps with higher detail and focused during presumably my lifetime. So here's an example of one of the plates from it on the upcoming 2008 eclipse. Well, in 1991, another Saros after the 1973 eclipse, I saw my second eclipse of Saros 136 from Baja, Mexico. And it was right about that time, or shortly thereafter, that the U.S. Naval Observatory terminated their service of publishing eclipse circulars because of budgetary cutbacks. And it was at that time they were sort of sniffing around and looking for somebody who would be willing to provide a similar service to the astronomical community with detailed eclipse prediction. And they asked me if I was interested in doing something like this. Now, mind you, they were not offering any technical assistance. They were not offering any financial assistance. And they would disavow any contact with me if I started undertaking this project. But I bit anyway and decided to get into the business. And I immediately thought, I need somebody to work with me on the weather, because all I know is what they tell me on the 6 o'clock news. So I got a hold of Jay Anderson, and he'd already worked on a couple of the circulars for the Naval Observatory, although they never gave him that much credit for it. I couldn't understand that. So Jay and I teamed up together to start working on the eclipse bulletins for NASA, and we started publishing the first one in 1994. In 1996, I traveled to Bucharest, Romania, for a NATO workshop planning meeting for the big 1999 eclipse going through Europe. And at that meeting, I ran into this character, Patrick Poitevin. And he'd been writing to me for about a decade or so. And I'd noticed in recent years he started doing something very strange. He started traveling to partial eclipses, to places like Spitsbergen. So he came up to me at the meeting. I hadn't met him, and he introduced himself to me. So I was interested to meet someone who would travel halfway around the world for a partial eclipse. That's the first I had heard of that. But we hit it off pretty well right off the bat, and he invited me to come to Belgium the next year to give a talk to a big astronomy organization there. And that accomplished for me two big important things in my life. The first was that he introduced me to Belgian beer. And the second was I got to meet finally my lifelong mentor, Jean Mayus. And we had a number of interesting discussions. We'd been corresponding for years and years, of course, about eclipses. But that sort of set the wheels turning in the back of my head. I would like to some kind of a project that Jean and I could work on together. Well, the years went by. I worked on more eclipse bulletins with Jay. And in the 1990s, I started thinking about possibly a new solar eclipse cannon. What advantage could a new solar eclipse cannon give? Something that would cover a large period of time. But it would use modern solar and lunar ephemerides. The previous cannons that had been written and produced were using ephemerides from as old as 1900 or 1950, and there were newer, more accurate models for the moon and sun's orbit. But we would want to use something with better accuracy. It would cover a large historical time like Uppelzer and the 1983 cannon back to 2000 BC through the present. But I also wanted to go far enough into the future to be useful to look ahead, even just out of curiosity. I also thought it would be a good idea to have, like the 83 cannon, a map for every single eclipse so you could look up partials as well and put political boundaries on them so it would help you identify where particular eclipses were passing through and aid in the geographic visibility. The eclipse curve should have more details on them. They should actually show you, instead of just the central line, they should show you where the northern and southern limits are so you can get an estimate of what's in the path of totality and what isn't. It should give you the northern and southern limits of the partial phases, the sunrise and sunset curves, and also even throw in the eclipse magnitude of 0.5 so you could estimate what the magnitude is in any particular location on the eclipse map. This is a lot to fit in on almost 12,000 maps and try to stuff it into a book that's big enough that you don't need a wheelbarrow to carry around. So it took a little bit of thought on that front. And it would also use the very best values of delta T, that parameter that shifts an eclipse path east or west because of the irregular slowdown of the Earth's rotational rate. And a lot of work had been done on the historical determination of delta T over the past decade or so, and from the 1980s through present, by Stevenson and Morrison. So there were much better values of those than had been used in any of the previous cannons. And finally, I wanted to add another feature, and that was an estimate of the path shift due to the uncertainty in Delta T that had never been addressed before in any eclipse bulletins or any eclipse canons. Finally, one other thing was that I knew that I would have limited finances to publish something like this, so I wouldn't be able to make as many copies of a canon as I would for the, as say, the eclipse bulletins. This would be a much larger publication. So to compensate for that, I wanted this to be the first bulletin to be widely available on the internet as a PDF so that anybody could download it. So that was, those were the basic ideas that I had in developing this. I then approached John about this and asked him if he would be interested in collaborating on this. And to my delight, he immediately accepted, and we discussed this and fine-tuned some of the fine points on this. And after about 2 years of work, we published the canon of solar eclipses, the five millennium canon, in late 2006. And I just want to hit some of the highlights of the canon. Here's a typical page for the current period, 2006 and onward. Just to give you a flavor, for those of you who haven't seen it yet, of some of the information that's on there, I'm going to zoom in a little bit on one of the plates. And you can see now, you've got northern and southern limits on the path. Here's 50% magnitude, northern and southern limits of the penumbra, the sunrise-sunset loops. You've got political boundaries, the equator, a little bit of technical information in the corners, as much as I could squeeze in. And with that, decided that an image scale of about 20 eclipses per page would produce a book that was around 600 pages. So there were budget considerations on designing this thing, too. And this is a blow-up of the key for the maps, just to show you how much information is stored in each one of these maps. If we compare the 2006 canon with the 1983 on the same scale, it gives you a flavor of the difference in the amount of information. The 1983 was cutting edge in its day, and I can imagine maybe in sometime in the not too distant future, another canon will supersede this one that'll have three-dimensional models on Google Maps that you can plug in. Well, we've already got that on the internet, don't we? But still having the hard copy, there's something about having that book that you can pull off the shelf and put in your lap and thumb through it. That's still a delight to me. Well, let me talk a little bit about some of the content of the Five Millennium Canon. Of course, there's a lot of statistics in here to look at that big chunk of time, to look at how the frequencies of various eclipses stack up. Some of this information is a little bit easier to see on a pie chart diagram of the frequency of partials, annulars, totals, and hybrid eclipses. But we also investigate a lot of different types of eclipses. Of course, with annulars and totals, they can be subcategorized because you can have, for instance, an annular eclipse. Your typical annular eclipse has two limits, a northern limit and a southern limit. But if the antumbral shadow passes near the edge of the Earth, the northern edge of the shadow never hits the Earth. It remains in space. Or vice versa, down at the southern edge of the Earth, the southern edge of the shadow misses the Earth, so that the eclipse ends up having only one limit. So that's this second case here, central eclipse with one limit. Finally, you can have a third case where not only the edge of the shadow, but the center of the shadow misses the Earth, and just one edge of it hits the Earth. That's a non-central eclipse with one limit. So we looked at the statistics and the frequency of those types of eclipses too, both for annular eclipses and for total eclipses. Statistics for hybrid eclipses, some of the similar information with hybrids, where you have an eclipse that's total in certain parts of the path and annular at other parts. Most people think of that as an eclipse that begins annular, turns total, and changes back to annular. But there are actually some subcategories of that. You have some hybrid eclipses that begin as a total and regress into annular at the end. They only have one phase change. Or they begin as annular and change to total. So we looked at the statistics of those as well, just for pure entertainment value and interest. There are cables in the canon that break down the frequency of different types of eclipses by century, by 100-year chunks. So you can look at the number of annulars, number of totals, number of the hybrids. And you see some interesting periodicities and frequencies in here. For instance, if you look at the number of hybrid eclipses, you see that it tends to peak up here from 1300 to 1700. We get a high concentration of them, and then it drops down here. So some interesting things buried in some of this information that's telling us something about the frequencies of and harmonies in the orbits of the Earth and the Moon. More statistics, the number of solar eclipses in any given year. You can have as few as two and as many as five. Most of the time, you can see over 70% of the time, there are only two eclipses in a given year. In case of five eclipses in a given year, here's a table that looks at all of them that are in the canon. There are 25 examples with the years right there. And you can see with an eclipse of in a year that has five eclipses, four of them are always partial, and the fifth one is a central eclipse, either total, annular, or hybrid. We also had some information in there about the theoretical maximum duration of totality, which varies over the centuries because of the changing ellipticity primarily of the Earth and Moon's orbit, and also the duration is different at the two different nodes because the geometry is different. But during the current epoch, the maximum duration is 7 minutes and 32 seconds at the ascending node. And if we look at long eclipses during the current period, the eclipses with a duration of over 7 minutes, the last one was in 1973. The next one, unfortunately, isn't until 2150. Theoretical maximum duration of annularity, same kind of information. It changes at the nodes and over time. Right now, the maximum duration is about 12 minutes, 29 seconds. And again, looking at the eclipses with a duration of 12 minutes or more, it's interesting to note that the 1973 eclipse was the last one for over 1,000 years into the future that had a duration of over 12 minutes. However, the next another eclipse in that same Saros series, Saros 141, in 2010, has a duration of 11 minutes and 8 seconds. That's the eclipse that passes through Africa and southern India and into Asia. That will be the longest annular eclipse well into the fourth millennium. The value of delta T is critical in doing these eclipse calculations. And I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip through that very quickly. But it's really important to point out that, for instance, 2,000 years ago, the estimated error in delta T is over 3,700 seconds. That's an hour in time. That could shift the eclipse path by 15 degrees. So if you look at eclipse paths back at 2,000, the year minus 2000, you have to take into account that path you're looking at has an uncertainty of plus or minus 15 degrees on the Earth's surface. You can move that path around quite a bit. A lot of times people see a map and they say, that's exactly where the eclipse path is, but you have to take into account the uncertainty. We do that on the eclipse maps by plotting these dotted gores down here. That's the plus or minus error bars on the central meridian, that you can rotate the map plus or minus through that angle for the uncertainty to take into account possible errors in delta T. So that's our nominal guess for this eclipse in 1996, minus 1996. But if we look at another solution with a positive estimate on the uncertainty, it shifts the path eastward. If we look at the same eclipse path with subtracting the uncertainty, it shifts the path westward. So that's the range of uncertainty for a particular eclipse given those error bars. There's information in the canon about various eclipse frequencies and periodicities, like the Saros cycle. We have a lot of tables in there giving the details of which eclipses are in each Saros cycle. And finally, we have on the NASA Eclipse site the page where you can download everything from the 5 millennium canon of eclipses. In addition to the 5 millennium canon being online, there's a catalog online where you can download particulars of any particular eclipse in 100-year intervals. It's got links to Saros catalogs, global maps for each individual eclipse in the entire catalog. I have plans of publishing just that catalog as hard copy in the next year or so. I couldn't fit it into the original canon because it would have added another 300 pages to the book, but I decided it's worth publishing as a separate publication. We also, Jean and I also hope to eventually publish a CD-ROM that contains the entire canon on it, plus the catalog, plus all the Basilian elements, plus some PC programs to manipulate some of this information, generate some maps and tables. Google Maps, we now have a tool on Google Maps, thanks very much to the efforts of Xavier Jouvier and my summer student, Sumit Duda, who worked with a number of programs, JavaScript, PHP, Ajax, MySQL. Most of it's alphabet soup to me. But they got the 5 millennium canon interfaced with Google Maps, so you can pick any time interval or any characteristics for an eclipse, get a table generated of eclipses, click on it, and it pops you into Google Maps where you can look at the eclipse path. On the horizon, Jean and I are already working on a 5 millennium canon of lunar eclipses. And that finishes it up. Thank you very much.
We have time for two questions.
The big earthquake off of Indonesia a couple of years ago that caused a huge tsunami.
Yeah.
They said it changed the Earth's rotation. Does that affect any of your calculations or maps?
In theory, it does. In practice, practically speaking, it does not. I read a short article on this, and it's minuscule that's going to affect, and it's one shot, whereas delta T is an additive effect, slow down, summed over days and days and years and years, just one little jolt.
That would have been a major bummer, wouldn't it?
Well, I would have given me some more work. Give me a visit.
Obviously, you can see the labor-intensive Holter's work. By the time, so that's probably why nothing got done again until 1986. Non-computerized.
Absolutely. Yeah, the 1966 canon was possible because computers had finally gotten fast enough to do this kind of work. Yeah, because to do it by hand. Looking back and reading more about how Oopelzer did this, and there's a great article about Oopelzer that Will Carton published in Sky and Telescope in 1989. And it's a really good article to find out some of the work, what was involved in producing Oopelzer canon. And it's a miraculous work even by today's standards. The intensity, the amount of work it required to produce something like that needed a special talent like Oopelzer to undertake something like that. Otherwise, it would have had to waited until there would have been no Oopelzer. Mayus would have been the first one. Thank you very much.
Hey, just a minor technical adjustment here.
Yeah.
We're all right.